Welcome to In the Studio with the 21st Century Perspective on history's greatest rock albums.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One, two, three.
I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the female singer who is the most successful female rocker of the 1980s.
Hit me with your best shot. Why don't you hit me with your best shot? No, hell is for children.
I had a record company and a management group that refused to be open-minded. And what happened is it was a constant battle with them. I was already gone. By the time this record came out, I was already moving to another place, except that they weren't letting me. And at that time, they still had control. They had contractual control. I didn't have a choice at that time. And that was when I said, you can do anything you want, but you can't make me make records. And if you don't let me make the kinds of records that I want to make, I won't make them anymore.
Oh,
yeah, Redbird, you got to understand that when the wife was going through these times in 81, the record company was airbrushing,
my clothes off.
Clothes. They were airbrushing clothes. They were doing everything. We're talking about control from management and the record company that really, she couldn't really do anything.
Love is a battlefield.
Hi, this is Pat Benatar.
And I'm Neil Giraldo.
And we're in the studio.
No less than the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll states emphatically in its opening biography line, and I quote, "Pat Benatar was the most successful hard rock singer of the 80s. And writer Stephen Stolder points out, and I quote, "With the arrival of the 1980s, Nancy Reagan was picking out new White House china, MTV was taking its first baby steps, and Pat Benatar was surging forward as a new kind of female rock star. Brassy, eye-catching, and possessed of a 4.5-octave voice, the small-framed, big-voiced New Yorker first caused a stir in 1979 with the hit Heartbreaker," end quote. 26 years earlier, she was born Pat Andruszewski in Brooklyn, New York. Her mother had been in the chorus of the New York City Opera, but quit when Pat was born. Her father worked in a sheet metal plant. Pat remembers her childhood home in Lindenhurst, Long Island, as being filled with music, mostly operas and polkas, and she's got no doubt that Pat inherited the multi-octave singing range from her mother. But try as she did, the strict, uncompromising world of opera singing was not the place for young Pat.
It was just really boring. It was hard being 18 and singing that kind of music. It was just hard. I couldn't, it was like too much of a paradoxical thing, singing that and acting another way. And it just got so boring. And by the time it came to get, I was studying to prepare to audition for Juilliard, and I just quit. I just couldn't take it. I said, forget this. I don't want to do this. I had this one teacher in Virginia who, you had to wear a harness, a rigid kind of thing. It wasn't a supple thing. And it would measure how far. You had to meet a certain mark on the harness. It would go over your shoulders and around your diaphragm. And the point was to expand your diaphragm till it touched the sides. It's like kind of like boxing, when you're breathing, they're smacking you in the stomach. She would hit us with a pointer, the long way, as you're singing, while you're singing the song, so that you would build up your diaphragm, the muscles in your diaphragm. And she would whack you with the stick so that you wouldn't falter while you were doing it. It was incredible.
That's cool.
Oh,
don't you mess around with me. You're a heartbreaker, dream maker, love taker. Don't you mess around with me. You're a heartbreaker, dream maker.
What a debut in 79. In the heat of the night, that's Pat Benatar with Heartbreaker. She continued voice lessons until 19, even after marrying her high school boyfriend Dennis Benatar and moving in with him to Richmond, Virginia. Pat started out as a singing waitress, doing Liza Minnelli songs with blue cheese stains on her apron. Then, Pat began singing in a local cover band, finally deciding that Richmond was not the place to pursue her career.
I was formally married when I was 19, and my ex-husband was drafted, so I went to college down south. That's where we were drafted to, and that's when I worked the extra jobs because you don't make any money in the service. So, and I just did all that extra, you know, all those silly jobs down there and, you know, make a living and go to school for a little while. And then I decided, I went to a concert and I saw all these people screaming and jumping around, and I said, I know I could do this. I could do this. So I quit my job and started singing. When I moved back to New York, I hooked up with a bunch of local musicians and songwriters. And once I started singing original songs and not cover songs or, you know, Cole Porter songs, things that people had sung before, you stopped mimicking other people. And that's when I found my real voice. It finally came out because of that. Because I had to make up, you know, you have to sing songs from scratch. You really don't have anybody to listen to learn it from. You have to just find your own way of doing it. Eventually, it emerged, but it took a long time. It took about 3-4 years.
Pat and Dennis Benatar moved back to New York City in 1975, but the couple drifted apart while Pat worked the cabaret circuit, including a stint at the club Catch a Rising Star. It was there that Pat landed a recording deal that would launch her debut album In the Heat of the Night in late 1979. The impact was almost immediate, yet Pat Benatar and her musical director, guitarist, songwriter Neil Giraldo, were too busy on their first U.S. tour to even notice.
The great thing about it is we had no idea what was going on. When you're out that long and you're playing clubs and you're not, and you're a new band, you really don't have any of the luxuries or, you know, the things that go along with touring. I mean, nobody's like calling you up and telling you, you know, your record's doing great. None of this. You're just out there every day playing. So we didn't have any idea that the record was even doing well or anything like that.
We were told, like, when it started moving up, though, they would say, yeah, well, you know, it moved up, like, 15 points or something like that. Oh, great.
Oh, that's great. But
I don't know what that means. You know, we don't know what that means.
I didn't have any
idea. It means something, you know.
And then when we got to Virginia Beach to do this concert at this club, this little club, I think it was called Peabody's or something, and that's when we really, I think, for me anyway, when I really understood what was happening. We got there, and we drove up, and all these people. I mean, there was this huge crowd of people outside this building. I went, oh, my God, there must have been a fire. What happened? I'm looking, I'm going, oh, no, the gig, we can't play. There must have been a fire. There were police. There were people everywhere. And it was because this show had sold out, and all the people in the street were trying to get tickets, and they were, like, having a fit. When they told me why, I called Rick Newman, our manager at the time, and he said, the record's like number 13. He was like, we had no idea. So that's when I kind of got a clue about what was happening then.
You want me to leave, you want me to stay. You ask me to come back, you turn and walk away. You want to be lovers, then you want to be friends. I'm losing my patience, you need.
patience, you're nearing the end.
From her second album, Crimes of Passion, in 1980, that's Pat Benatar's Treat Me Right. For that second album cover photo, her record company had insisted that Pat Benatar wear the skimpy leotard that had caused such a sensation on her first tour. Inadvertently, Pat did for Dance Skin what Guns N' Roses did for the tattoo industry.
Well, that's why I wore it, because it was comfortable. You gotta understand, I grew up doing theater with dancers, in cabaret, where everybody just, no one could afford anything like that. And you didn't wear jeans. I mean, you didn't wear that. I mean, so this is what you wore, and it was comfortable. It didn't move around. I didn't want to be restricted by things falling, and I wanted to jump and, you know, that kind of thing. So this was the most comfortable thing. It was such a silly, naive time. I mean, I had no idea. I remember the first time we ever did a TV show, when we did rock concert, when Don Kirshner had that show. And when I saw the video of it, that was the first time we'd ever seen ourselves on TV or anything like that. When I saw what it actually looked, came across as, I went, oh no, it was never, I had no idea. You have to understand, it was a strange time for, I think, all women at that time. It's not so localized in the music industry and things like that. It was a strange time for us, period. It's that kind of thing where you spend generations and generations of one kind of stereotype. And when you're given the freedom to move out of that stereotype, you just move into a different kind of stereotype, because you haven't learned how to live without them, period. You know what I mean? That's what happened to most of us. You know, that was pretty much at the height of when everything was happening. And, you know, myself included, I mean, none of us knew where to go. We had, my whole philosophy was that freedom meant total freedom. That meant if you wanted to be, you know, the vamp type person, that's what total freedom meant, that no one but you could decide what was correct for yourself. There were no more boxes to be put in. Feminists couldn't box you in that way either, because that was all you were doing was moving out of the sexists, and then the feminists were telling you where you were to go. You know what I mean? So it was from one box to another box. My whole position was that true freedom meant you could go anywhere you wanted to go. And this is where the problem started to happen, because people who believed that, feminists who believed that philosophy, were on that other side with Treat Me Right, saying, we don't care what she wears, you know what I mean? Then there were the other ones saying, yeah, but look how she looks, you know what I mean? So that was the problem. But that was a problem that was common, I think, just to women in general, you know what I mean? Not to women caring about music and things like that. It was an exciting time, but it was very confusing, you know? And, you know, 10 years down the road, everybody figured out where they're supposed to be and what's cool and what's not, you know. It's not like today, when all of us made mistakes and now people can look at us and say, okay, well, we won't do what they did. That's the whole point of time passing, is people now that come out get to see what not to do. I had no one to look to.
Well, you're a real tough cookie with a long history of breaking little hearts like the one in me. That's okay, let's see how you do. Come on, you don't fight fair, but that's okay.
That's Pat Benatar's first top five single from her second album, 1980's Crimes of Passion, on its way to 4 million sold and Pat's first Grammy Award. But without meaning to, Pat was about to find herself at ground zero of the feminist revolution, a focal point of changing attitudes. Visit InTheStudio.net and keep track of In the Studio on Facebook. I'm Red Beard. Pat Benatar's next.
Hi, I'm Pat Benatar.
And I'm Neil Giraldo.
Welcome back to In the Studio, and now back to Redbeard.
With bandleader Neil Giraldo by her side, Pat Benatar's performances and songwriting on Crimes of Passion surpassed anything she'd done before. The sessions produced one of her most impassioned songs ever, certainly her most misunderstood. Hell is for Children. Here's Pat Benatar in the studio.
I started writing with Roger Capps, our old bass player, because I had read this huge article in the New York Times that was a kind of like a serial article that went on for a couple of weeks. And it was the first time that I came from a really small town. I mean, if anybody was ever abused, you certainly never heard about it. And I had no idea what extent it had, you know, gotten so out of hand in the country. And this article was just, you know, a bombardment of statistics and gruesome, you know, accounts and cases and convictions and this and this and this, and it was like such saturation that by the time the week was over, I was devastated. I had no idea that this was going on, and I, for some reason, it just became like my thing, my pet thing from that time on. And Roger and I started to write the song, and we told Neil we had these lyrics and things, and we didn't know what to do with it because we thought it was kind of too heavy to, you know, how do you do this and make it, you know, it was 1980. We didn't know what to do, and we wanted to make it a viable rock song, you know what I mean? And the whole point of that thing, when Neil, we had the lyrics and all we had was that thing, Hell is for Children. I told Neil that I wanted it to sound like pain. So that's why that screaming is in there, because he just wrote it so that it would sound like pain. And every night when I do it, that's the motivation behind it. But it's true.
No, it's true.
The motivation when I'm screaming up there is so that you hear the agony, whatever they're going through. That was the point of that chorus, that repeated thing over and over again, you know. And I mean, it's, if you could see the faces of the people when we're doing it, I mean, I have kids cry. You just want to die.
They go behind.
Oh, God, they go crazy for it. And it's so worth it for everything that ever happened just to watch them.
Children, and you should.
Rock's first anti-child abuse song from the Crimes of Passion album, Pat Benatar, nevertheless, took a lot of flack from those who never bothered to listen past the title refrain. Meanwhile, she had to deal with a public image that had nothing to do with the kind of person she really was. Rolling Stone magazine put her on the cover with the headline, Rock's Newest Sex Symbol, a marketing man's dream. But it was Pat Benatar's nightmare.
It was personal growth. I mean, by the time we had gotten to this, we had learned and experienced a lot of things in a very short time. I was reexamining my reasons for doing it, period, and what I intended to do in the next phase. And, you know, what happened was that I had a record company and a management group that refused to be open-minded. And what happened is it was a constant battle with them. I was already gone. By the time this record came out, I was already moving to another place, except that they weren't letting me. And at that time, they still had control. They had contractual control. I didn't have a choice at that time. And that was when I said, you can do anything you want, but you can't make me make records. And if you don't let me make the kinds of records that I want to make, I won't make them anymore. And that was, you know, the beginning of the end of this whole thing.
You better hide. You better leave from my side.
From 1981's Crimes of Passion, her second album, that's a cover of the Rascals' classic, You Better Run, by Pat Benatar. For this and your other favorite interviews, visit inthestudio.net and follow In the Studio on Facebook. I'm Redbeard. Pat Benatar comes back with Neil Giraldo next, In the Studio, for Pat Benatar's greatest hits.
Hi, I'm Pat Benatar.
And I'm Neil Giraldo.
Welcome back to In the Studio, and now back to Redbeard.
Thank you both. Just before the Precious Time album was released in 1981, Pat Benatar was quoted as saying that if she were treated the same way as some of the women in her songs, she would, quote, inflict serious injury on the guy. There would be blood in the streets, end quote. I asked Pat Benatar if she really said that then.
I absolutely said that, and I still absolutely mean it.
I like that. That's really good.
I still mean it today.
Oh, shit.
I mean, I don't like to only sing about songs that make me mad. You got to understand, I was 27 years old. I had a lot of machismo going, you know what I'm saying? I came off a few years of a very bad relationship. I was around a lot of girlfriends who went through hell with, you know, men who were just, you know. You have to understand, I grew up with the women's movement. I was like, you know, I was ready to stretch and flex, and I was happening, so... Yeah, I mean, I still would inflict serious injury if somebody really gave me a lot of crap. Ooh, I'm tough, I know. But I've mellowed, you see. I learned to, you know, put the glove on the fist, you know? That's what I learned.
Ooh, you're giving me the fever tonight. I don't want to give in. I've been playing with fire. You forget I've seen you work before. Take them straight to the top. Just tear it apart.
Fire and Ice is a great song for Pat Benatar's double platinum third effort, Precious Time, in 1981. After selling more than 4 million copies of her preceding album, expectations for her third were extremely high.
I don't know. You know, it's always mixed. I mean, it was very euphoric because, you know, it was great to achieve what we achieved. And at the same time, the pressure was incredible to have to do this next record. I mean, it's just something that happens. They can tell you it's going to happen, and you know it's going to happen, and there isn't anything you can do about it. It just happens. External. It's never internal. It's the people on the outside, you know, wanting you to perform. And unfortunately, the thing that happens is once you've had a success, in my view of things now, you know, after all these years, is that once you've had a success, people are so locked in, it's so hard for them to let go, that any deviation from that causes havoc. And I'd have to say over the next 8 years that followed, that was the biggest problem. And of course that stifles you musically because you're growing and they're not.
Never again, isn't that what you say? You've been through this before, you swore this time you'd think with your head. No one would ever have you again. And if taken was gonna get done, you decide where and when. Just when you think you got it done, your heart's acutely tied and bound.
Just when you think you got it down,
Promises in the Dark was a hit from 1981's Precious Time album for Pat Benatar. The song was co-written with her guitarist Neil Giraldo. Soon, their professional relationship would take a very personal turn.
No, I think it all was at the same time.
Yeah, it was professional on his part. It was pure lust on mine.
No, oh, boy. It all, Redbeard, don't listen to her.
I liked you right away.
It happened all at the same time. You know, in other words, I came in to play some guitar, and then and to be the musical director of the band, which led to being the producer and all that other stuff, that good stuff that goes with that. at the same time, we was falling in love. So
I just give you a hint: the first time I ever saw him, I was just recently divorced. I mean, by a very short time, and I was looking very forward to being single and famous and all those kinds of things. And he walked in, and I called my very best friend that night, and I said, I met the father of my children. She said, you're out of your mind. So it was a ton of bricks.
We're running with the shadows of the night. So baby, take my hand, it'll be all right. Surrender all your dreams to me tonight. They'll come true in world, it's a cold world when you keep it all to yourself. I said you can't hide on the inside all the pain you've ever felt. Ransom my heart, but baby, don't look back, 'cause we got nobody else. We're running with the shadows on. It's all moving way too fast. Use every alibi and word to deny the love ain't meant to last.
With an almost Phil Spector-ish wall of sound, Shadows of the Night turned out to be a number 13 hit for Pat Benatar in 1982. It helped her score a second Grammy Award. Pat also landed a husband that year, but she didn't have to look far.
Well, yeah, but they begged us not to get together. You're going to ruin it. You're going to break up the band. They were like, distraught, but we said tough. You know, when we wrote together in those days, it was still so very new, and I was always so embarrassed to give him my lyrics, you know. So we had a little, in the house we were renting, he had a little a room that he had all his equipment set up, and he would go in there and he would write, and I would slip them under the door because I was just too ashamed to, like, show, and he was never allowed to, like, look at them and me at the same time, so... And, yeah, I mean, this was a personal song, you know. It was just about a tiff, and it was about questioning where we were going and all that kind of thing. And, you know, and then, of course, it was embellished with other people's situations and things. So literally slipped them under the door.
Nah, she's lying.
You lie. I did, too. I remember doing it. I was just so embarrassed. I mean, he would think it was...
Well, she would say, you know, I got this idea. I got this. I think it's really good. I go, oh, great. I love to see it.
No,
well,
you
no,
can't.
I can't see it yet.
Yeah.
Okay,
I can't
I'll wait a little while. Then I'll wait a little while and she'll say, you know, I got this idea. Let me just tell you this. Don't laugh. I'm not laughing. And she'll look at me and I'm not laughing. And she goes, you're laughing. I'm not laughing. If you say it enough times, I'm going to laugh. And she would do that all the time. And she really did.
Especially
that.
When it was a personal situation. It was so hard. I mean, you have to understand our situation, our relationship was not, it wasn't like being able to hold in and cover up your feelings. You were exposing your feelings to the person that you were writing about. It was a very strange thing to do. I mean, you had to, like, you know, bite the bullet and just do it because I knew it was worthwhile to do. But, you know, personally, as his, you know, significant other, it was tough.
But for a woman whose lyrics were so intimately personal that she had to shove them under the door to her composer husband to set the music, then what must it be like to sing those sentiments night after night with husband Neil accompanying her on stage just 10 feet away in front of 15,000 strangers?
Well, it's liberating. I mean, you know, at first it's very uncomfortable, but by the time you get to the stage that you're going to sing it in front of everyone, all that's worked out. You know, you've worked it out with yourself, and it's very freeing. It's like going to the shrink, you know what I mean? You go to the shrink, and the first few times it's really impossible to say anything, and then after that it's like, you know, it's what they say, the truth will set you free, and that's what happens. Everything is on the table, and it's just, to me, it's a positive thing. But that comes only with time and with growth and maturity. I mean, it doesn't happen initially, I don't think, unless you're just wonderful, you know, which I'm sure most of us aren't.
By 1982, Pat Benatar and her now husband, bandleader Neil Giraldo, felt that they had to issue both Pat Benatar's label and management an ultimatum. She needed to take back final control over how her image was marketed. Was Pat Benatar really threatening to walk away from millions in album sales, arena headlining tours, MTV Queen, and 4 Grammy Awards? Neil Giraldo says you don't want to challenge Pat Benatar's poker face.
My wife's got she's got strong intentions. When she says something, she really means it. I mean, she's not one to kind of like twist an idea. She tells you right up front what it is. I don't know. I'm just so glad she's what she is.
He was supportive. I mean, you know, he was right there always. He was right behind me saying, I'm not scared. You do what you got to do. You know what I mean? And whatever it takes. And he was always supportive. We stood together, allied against the forces of evil. And, you know, sometimes we lost. I mean, they had made our lives hell for a little bit. But, you know, in the end, I truly believe that we were right. Because the most important thing when you're making music is that you must be true to yourself. You have got to make music that you believe in, that you feel, or you might as well do something else.
Yeah, Redbird, you got to understand that when the wife was going through these times in 81, the record company was airbrushing, you know,
my clothes off.
Clothes. They were airbrushing clothes. They were doing everything. We're talking about control from management and the record company that really, she couldn't really do anything. I mean, in other words, we were making records. We were trying to do something, and we were getting told what we're supposed to do,
right.
If you don't what we can do and what we can't do, and they would play both ends against the middle.
We are young, hearty to heart, we stand. No promises, no demands. Love is a battle.
Still, no one can tell us where we're wrong.
Going all the way to number 5 for Pat Benatar in 1983, Love is a Battlefield was found on an otherwise all-live album. The result? A 3rd Grammy Award for Best Female Rock Vocal for Pat Benatar. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this.